You better listen to me. Never trust the heart of a man.
Lauren Carlson is a poet, a teaching artist, and a spiritual director. She's author of the poetry chapbook, Animals I Have Killed. She and her family live in Dawson, Minnesota, and she's going to be part of the lineup. She'll be presenting at the upcoming Rural Arts and Culture Summit in Grand Rapids, and she joins us now on KAXE KBXE. Lauren, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first I want to start our conversation with where you live, because rural places don't always get defined by the people who actually live in those rural places. What is Dawson like?
Oh, yeah, this is a really great question. Dawson is a town of about 1,200 people, and when I moved here, I didn't realize I was going to live in rural Dawson. So if you're not from a small town or a rural area, you probably aren't aware of the distinction, as I was not. I actually grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, but not Minnesota. It's a mistake sometimes people make when I tell them I'm from Grand Rapids, but I always have to clarify. But anyway, I live 6 miles south of Dawson in Providence Township. So I'm not even in town. So if I look out my window, the closest neighbor I have is about a mile and a half down the road. I live across the street from an old church cemetery, and the half mile north is a branch of the Lac Parle River. So for me, I really define rural as not even in town. You're really immersed in sort of a natural environment or a farming environment, agriculture environment, and then you have to go out of your way, actually, to find other humans to interact with. So that's what it's like for me. But in town, I think of as a bustling, busy place compared to my location in Providence. At one time, it was much busier here. I think that was probably in the 40s. I'm not too good on my history of the area since I've lived here about 10 years. But yeah, that summarizes my experience of what I'd call rural.
And it sounds like you love rural.
I do. I had no idea I would enjoy it this much. I came from Chicago. My husband went to seminary in Chicago, so we were there. I went to undergrad there, and I loved living in the city. There was tons of things to do. It felt like there was a lot of excitement and energy, but I also didn't realize how much stress it added to my life. I had to it was like other people became obstacles, and here it's engaging and wonderful, and I can focus on forming relationships because I actually have to go out of my way to find human relationship. But there it was like you're waiting in line at the bus, you're trying to get your spot seat on the L train, even at the doctor's office is like a 2-hour wait. And I didn't realize how much micro stress that added to my life on a daily level until I moved to where I live now, and all of that sort of faded away. It was really amazing to me.
Boy, that doesn't even sound like micro stress, does it? It's macro stress.
It's totally different. But when you're in it, it's like when you're in life, because just it is the pace of life. I know it's probably cliche, but it's just a totally different competitive vibe I found in the, and especially in the bigger cities.
So as a poet, as an artist in a rural area, do you have more opportunity? Do you have different opportunities?
That is such a good question. Something people ask me a lot is, do I enjoy living where I live? Or a very simple question like the one you just asked, is there more opportunity? Is there less? And people, I think, assume there's less opportunity for me. But I was just speaking with someone the other day who had read my book and said, you know, I really have the gift of time and intention out here. And Minnesota, I also think, is a supportive state for the arts. We have, thank you, Land Legacy Act. You know, I'm active with the Southwest Minnesota Arts Council, and there's so much funding and I think regional support just in terms of attendance of arts events. In Dawson, even, I think that because there aren't as many other things competing with our time and attention, and the community is so relationally focused that people who might not be interested in poetry at all will come to a poetry reading I'm giving because they know me. And so I don't think you necessarily get that in a bigger city because you are more anonymous, so there aren't going to be the same people that would come who would never come to a poetry reading, but they know you, so they'll come support you. I just think, I would say maybe a different kind of support. It's more relational and more based on the person and the community that we have out here in our small towns.
It's interesting to hear you say relationally focused, because then I don't want to get into any sort of political thing, but obviously rural areas have been defined by national media, especially in the last couple of years. And I think that's probably the biggest element that is missed about politics, that you work side by side with your neighbors on projects, and actually politics don't even come up that much in what you do.
Yeah. Well, it was funny. I heard someone say, like, there was someone, I think it was an intern in their church or something, had come from a bigger city, and I think what we learn out here is you could have a really strong disagreement with someone, but you're going to see them the next day at the grocery store. So you don't have the same opportunity. I know it's a cliche also to talk about Minnesota nice, but I do think in rural towns, we're stuck with each other a lot of times. So we have a lot of room and grace for each other. And we know that people, it takes a lot of work to change people. I saw a great speaker at a training I was at recently, and he was talking about just intentional listening and really listening to understand. And someone asked a question like, well, if I'm listening for understanding, how can I try to change someone's mind? And he was like, you can't. The point is you give them the best opportunity to change their own mind by making sure you understand 100% where they're coming from. And that really struck me, that we can have sort of, it can work both ways. Like, there's a lot of civility and grace we have for one another, but also it can mean sometimes problems sink below the surface. And so that's why I really like, in my arts practice as a poet, I don't have to be responsible for any answers, which is kind of a great thing. I am only responsible for asking questions in a different way. So people are maybe coming to problems outside their normal, I would say, like, paths of thinking, and that can get you jump-started into creative solutions.
We're speaking with Lauren Carlson. She's going to be speaking and facilitating at the Rural Arts and Culture Summit in Grand Rapids next week. So, Lauren, let's talk about this one you're going to be speaking at. It's Working Towards Equity in Rural Communities Through Female-Led Artistic Interventions and Creative Action. Wow, that's a lot. But I was stunned when I saw this quote. It said, a recent Creative Minnesota report stated that female artists receive only 50% on the dollar of what male artists are paid in southwestern Minnesota. And Heidi and I were talking about, maybe it's everywhere. I was stunned by that. Explain.
Oh, yeah, that is a great question. So I think there's two ways to approach that question. You can say, like, is this a problem in the system? Is this a problem that we as female artists are creating ourselves? Like, is it that we're not giving ourselves enough value? Am I undervaluing my own work when I'm trying to sell it? And I'll tell you that I think sometimes there's a lot of hesitancy I see in my relationships with other women to self-identify as an artist, to kind of stand up there and say, I'm a poet. So I hear a lot of people saying things like, well, I'm a stay-at-home mom, and I used to do this myself too. So I'm speaking, I think I can only speak for myself here, is that there was a tendency to diminish the creative work I was doing. And then you undervalue it, you undercharge for it, you don't ask for the compensation that you deserve. And so part of what we're doing is coming together as a group of women and, like, just, I think, through informal networks of relationships, saying, hey, you know what? Like, I'll look at a grant application my friend is putting together, and I'll say, you know, I think you really underpaid yourself there. Why don't you ask for more money? Ask for what you deserve. You've been doing this. You've been organizing poetry readings, and you've been doing this administrative work for 15 years. So don't put yourself in at the entry level. And so I think part of it is coming together and teaching ourselves to recognize our own value. And because that's where it really started for me, was to sort of get out there and say, hey, I'm a poet, and to say, hey, I'm a teaching artist, and working with other organizations, taking advantage of the advantages of those trainings where they say, this is where you should value your work at. And it's really, I think it was really hard for me to come to the realization that I've been doing this work a long time, and this is the going rate. You know, I feel like there's pressure as a woman to take care of other people and to not bother people or to be very agreeable in sort of the negotiating space, and also really wanting everyone to have equal access. But recognizing your worth just means you're that much more available to volunteer and be a part of your community, because you're not having to run yourself thin in other places. And so part of it is recognizing that when we as women come together and acknowledge our own work and are valuing it the way it should be valued, that we really have more space, time, and resources to lift up everyone in our community. And so it'll be interesting, our focus when we're there. We really want to make it interactive. And I think so many times you go to panels, and I hope ours isn't like this, but like you just said, our really great, amazing title, and then you attend and you're like, oh, well, that's sort of what I expected. But we really want people to sort of claim their own artistry in our panel. And so we'll be working about why we show up for each other and how to pretty much assess our value and value it equally with everybody else.
So it's interesting to hear you talk about this, learning to value what you do in the world, because the other talk that you're giving is kind of the other side of it, because you need to value what you do, but you also have to be okay with the title of the other talk is Spectacular Failures. And I find that concept so interesting. And I think women especially have a hard time with it. If there's stumbling blocks along the way, it's really easy to get down on yourself and not do the work that you want to do.
Yeah, this is something I'm really passionate about. I don't know if I heard it on the radio. Maybe I was listening to NPR while I was driving in the car. I do a lot of driving. But they were talking about how women are taught to sort of please in the classroom, or we teach young girls to make the teacher happy, but we teach boys to take risks. We teach men to fail. Now, I don't have the research. I don't know whomever was speaking, if all of this is valid and true, but it really resonated with me that as women, there does feel, or I could just speak for myself, that failure seemed unimaginable. And once I took the step of, no, wait, this is a necessary part of the creative process, because I'm never going to discover new ways to do things if I'm doing things I know will succeed, because that usually means you've done it before. So there's no way I can be an expert in something I've never done before. So really taking on the idea of failure as a place of discovery and deep learning, and not to be avoided at all costs, really helped me flourish in my artistic process. And just as a poet, you get rejected a lot. You're always submitting things to literary journals. And I will say I have failed at this goal every year I have set it, but you try to aim for 100 rejections. So it's a way of sort of flipping, like instead of getting 10 acceptances, I'm going to try to send out 100 to 100 different literary journals and hope they reject me, because that means I'm in the game. Like that means I'm actively taking part in that process. And so far I've failed, but not on purpose. And it's really funny because sort of tricks you psychologically. Then when you get an acceptance, you have this like disappointment, because you're like, oh no, I have to send out more work now. I'm not off the hook.
So Lauren, we've got John here who's a man, and I'm curious, John, we would like to know, is failure the same sort of thing for you? Because Lauren and I are kind of talking about from a female point of view that it's hard to understand. Let's put him on the spot, Lauren.
Well, here's the deal.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. I'd love to hear it.
In sports, if I fail, I'm very, very upset at myself. That's just the competitive nature. But if it's in writing, or Heidi, if it's in doing something on the radio, speaking, or if it's trying to write a poem or something, I have no problem with failing because I expect to fail.
Wow.
I know that's kind of crazy to say, but... And everything you're saying is right, Lauren, but that's just kind of my perspective on things. I don't mind failing, to be honest with you.
Yeah, what I hear you saying is almost like losing is for what to me failure would be, right? Like losing a game or losing Like when I think about if you're valuing your own work, that's more negative than failing. Like you want to try the best that you can because losing is the worst. But I think I don't know if this was just me. I remember when I was a little girl, I would feel so guilty if I won in a competition because the other kid would look so sad. Like I just felt like this responsibility for the feelings of my opponents. And I have three boys. So full disclosure, and I don't see them have that same sadness, but it could just defend me. You know,
no.
It's easy to generalize. But I'm curious if that resonates with you at all.
Oh man, if I'm beating some, I'm burying them. I could care less. You know what I mean? You know, like you said,
softball.
You feel guilty.
We're talking
because
softball, well, or
like
basketball.
Yeah,
or
like the girls crying, and I think that's interesting because now in wrestling, in high school wrestling. It goes to be, say, just what you did. They do no longer raise the winner's hand because they don't want the loser to feel bad. And I think losers need to feel bad because it makes them play. It makes them, well, seriously, think about it. It makes them work harder to want to be better. And I would think that would be the same thing in art. You know, you go to a gallery and, you know, you've got one of your greatest pieces in there and you don't even get fifth place. And I would think that would fire you up to maybe do better or go in a different direction, or I don't know.
Oh yeah, I think you're raising an interesting question. Is as an artist, one thing you have to ask yourself is what motivates me more, my success or my own failure? Yeah. And that was something that helped me come to, I guess, make friends with failing, because I realized. When I failed, I did feel like, okay, I need to go out there and figure out what I did wrong. I need to learn from this. I need to get better. I need to read that many more books. I need to give this work to that many more other people to look at. But if I had a success, I sort of was like, okay, my work is done here. And I realized I was becoming complacent.
Sure.
And so that really helped me. And I think that's sort of what you're describing.
Absolutely.
But I still, the tender mother heart in me is like, oh no, but my poor son, if he loses the wrestling match,
yeah,
you know,
so
I do have sympathy for that guy still.
So Lauren, you have in this spectacular failures, you say the panelists are going to have some examples. Can you share one example with us of a failure?
Oh yeah. So we did, a project in the town of Milan, and we were trying to get sort of these health and safety or healthy housing assessments done with community members. And I mean, we could just not get anybody to try to fill these out. They're really basic assessment where someone would, like from the housing partnership would come into your house and just make sure you had like garbage cans and like radon testing, the smoke alarms that were working. But the hardest part was translating it. We were working with a community of Micronesian immigrants who speak the language Chukis. It's only 50,000 people in the world speak this language. And we couldn't really successfully translate and also get the community engaged and excited about what we were doing. And so we just felt like we wanted to get like 75 of these done. We did 10. It was a total failure. But the very exciting thing, and I didn't even know this was happening till later this fall, because of some of the work we did, partnerships were made between community members, and now the whole community is doing a wood carving project where they're making a traditional sailing vessel carved from a single tree, and it's the first time I think anybody has done this in Minnesota. I could be wrong. You'll have to look up more about it. But the great thing about it is the community is in charge of that project now. And me as the artist, I kind of failed in my area. But the community was able to take on relationships from when we were there and create their own thing that's been much more successful than anything I could have ever done. So that's my example. Is for me personally, it was a failure as a person doing community work. But if I take a step back and look at the bigger picture, it was really awesome, some of the things that have come out of that, and not even really to my credit at all. So that's really cool to see, though.
So we're talking with Lauren Carlson, because we're getting ready for this Rural Arts and Culture Summit that is next week in Grand Rapids. Have you been to one of these before? Can you give us an idea what it's like?
Yeah, I've been to two of them before when they've been in University of Minnesota Morris. and it's a great time. I think they have speakers, panelists. It's awesome for networking, finding people in the state that are, or even outside of Minnesota. I tend to focus on Minnesota because that's where I live, but really they'll have people from all over the country. And then last year they had international people represented as well. And it's sort of, I would say the main gist is that, you know, art happens in all places, and especially where there seems to be a lot of contention between rural and urban places, this is really a spot where people come together to learn from each other and see these spaces as on a continuum, and realizing that there's some of the same needs, whether you're in a really densely populated urban area or a remote rural area. There's some of the same problems with access to healthcare, with poverty, drug addiction, and arts experiences. So it's really awesome that we can all come together and find the places where, hey, look, how can we learn from each other, and how can we become stronger as a result of what we know about each other?
We talked with Michelle Anderson from Springboard for the Arts last week, and she said as of last week, there were 27 states that were being represented at the summit next week. So it's very, very, very exciting. We hope to see you at the open house here at KEXE next Thursday night. And Lauren, thank you so much for talking with us today. It was good to meet you.
Thanks. Yeah, good to meet you both as well.
You're listening to The Morning Show on KEXE KBXE. You can find information on Lauren's work at laurenkcarlson.com.
Of a cold, false-hearted lover and his low-down, lying, evil scheme. Oh, the sound of the voice.